rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Coming up on today's program, in the second hour of our program, conservative Republican Congressman Ron Paul of Texas will tell us about how the Fed has doubled our money supply in the last 10 years, and you find out how this is a disaster in the making for the United States. Also in our Taking Back Our Country segment, David Sanders will be here. He's a progressive running for Congress in the 4th Congressional District of Indiana. Our quote for the day from Woodrow Wilson, "Liberty has never come from the government. Liberty has always come from the subjects of it. The history of liberty is a history of resistance." Speaking of resistance, Yaron Brook, executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, is with us, AYNRAND.org. And Yaron, there's a new article over at AynRand.org that I believe you wrote that says, Hamas and Hezbollah's war on Israel is the inevitable result of Bush's immoral policy of promoting elections in Gaza and Lebanon instead of killing terrorists. How come you guys always want to use bombs when using food and hospitals and democracy have historically been more effective at winning hearts and minds?
Well, that's completely wrong. No conflict has ever been settled with democracy and food and water and hospitals.
Well, how do you think Hamas got elected in the Palestinian territories?
Hamas got elected because it is the only Palestinian entity ever to score a victory over the Israelis. It's the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza which led to the Hamas victory. They basically said, "We beat the Israelis." They withdrew, and the Palestinians who...
No, I'd say if anything, Fatah could say that.
70% of whom would like to see Israel eradicated from the face of the earth believe that Hamas has a much better chance of achieving that than the old Fatah, the old Palestinian Authority.
But you talk to people in the region and they say, you know, Hamas has been operating schools, they've been operating hospitals, they have won the hearts and minds of the people. I mean, why don't we do the same? Well, why don't we beat them at their own game?
Because they're not interested in food and hospital. That is not why Hamas won. It is true that is how Hamas has established itself over the years, but Hamas has grown and become a significant party in the Middle East when it started suicide bombings. That's when it really caught the hearts and minds of the Palestinians. It's when it killed Israelis on a mass scale and succeeded in doing that, not as succeeding in the suicide bombings, but succeeded in getting Israel to be scared, getting Israel to withdraw, getting Israel to be weak. The Palestinians are primarily, unfortunately, still interested in the destruction of the State of Israel. If they were really interested in economic success, there were plenty of opportunities from 94 to 2000 to achieve that. Indeed, Yasser Arafat would have signed a peace deal with Israel after Camp David in 2000, but they're not interested primarily in economic success. Their primary focus is the destruction of Israel. And it's time people realize that. The Palestinians are not nice guys. They're not the good guys. Even the Palestinian street are not the good guys. They are truly interested. They truly believe that Israel needs to be wiped off the face of the earth.
And yet you had, for example, in Ireland, the Irish Republican Army in the north, their original first intent was to fight the Orangemen, the British expatriates or the British immigrants into the north who essentially controlled Ireland, certainly Northern Ireland for all those years. It was finally when the British started improving the quality of life in Northern Ireland and helping jumpstart that economy that the IRA essentially said, "Hey, you know, bombs aren't working so well anymore. Jobs seem to work a whole lot better." Again, I don't get it. Why, even if the philosophy in the region, first of all, I don't entirely buy this. I've been in that region, and I've worked with both Arabs and Jews in that area, and I just don't. I think it's a profound oversimplification to say all the Arabs want to destroy all the Jews, and or on the other side, you got the folks who are saying, all the Jews are somehow terrorists or what. They're just terrible oversimplifications.
All you have to see is who wins elections in the Middle East. The elections that the Bush administration promoted in Egypt led to the victory or to increase substantial increase in success and of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Go to
and again, the Muslim Brotherhood is running schools and hospitals.
Go to the website of the Muslim Brotherhood and see their propaganda about Jews.
No,
Go to the website of the Muslim Brotherhood and see what they are advocating. They are
I agree with you, Yaron. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood is, you know, Khattab, the guy who was the founder of it, was the mentor of Osama bin Laden.
But you claim that they succeeded because of the hospitals.
In large part.
That they succeeded because of sympathy for this radical Islamist ideology in Egyptian culture. And I think that is a culture that is prevalent today in the Middle East. It's growing. As Israel and the U.S. are perceived as weak, and as Western, as the West has no real values to present to.
Well, I think we have a chicken and egg problem here, but the reality is that as long as we respond to it militarily, we feed it.
Okay, well, let's try this. The United States gives Egypt over $3 billion every year to build hospitals and promote well-being of the Egyptian people. We get absolutely no credit within Egyptian society for that.
That's not true. I've been in Egypt. The Egyptians are very fond of Americans.
No, they're
not. I've been to Egypt many times.
Egyptian street is not the intellectuals who are Western are very
I'm
fond.
Talking about people walking down the street.
The people in the streets are not. Israel.
Have you ever been there, Yaron?
Israel during the 1970s and during the 1980s developed the West Bank, developed Gaza, bought them electricity, bought them water, did things that the Jordanians and the Egyptians never did in the West Bank and Gaza. They built hospitals, they allowed universities, there was free press, there were newspapers in both regions. Under Israeli rule, Palestinians were freer and more prosperous than ever in their entire history. Did that change the fundamental hostility towards Israel? Absolutely not. You can't buy love with money. It's never worked in history, and indeed, I don't buy your interpretation of Northern Ireland. It's not true that economics drives history. That's an old Marxist idea, which is completely, absolutely wrong. Ideas drive history. The ideas held by these people are wrong.
So how many Palestinians are you going to have to kill before they stop saying, hey, you killed my brother, now I hate you even more?
Well, Israel's going to have to kill a lot, unfortunately, and then they're going to have to go into the schools and they're going to have to change those textbooks, because if they don't, I can tell you Israel won't exist in 30 years. The demographics play against it, and of course, their willingness to defend themselves is eroded every single year. So the Palestinians are far more committed to this struggle than the Israelis are, and therefore I see them winning in the long term. They hate the Israelis far more than the Israelis are willing to defend themselves.
How and why is this an issue that has anything to do with Ayn Rand, her writings, or objectivism, Yaron Brook?
Well, it has to do with Ayn Rand, and Ayn Rand actually said this in a speech in 1980 when she was asked about Israel. She said, in a struggle between a Western developed country that stands for similar values to those of the United States and the West, and between barbarism, it is incumbent on us to support the civilized, to support the Western.
Now, Lebanon is a democracy that we helped set up.
We have formal relations with them. A democracy that has Hezbollah in its government, we're not talking about parliament, in its government, is not a democracy worth defending, is not a democracy worth supporting.
Well, Northern Ireland is a democracy that has the IRA in its government, and we have relations with them.
Well, the IRA has completely, supposedly, right, returned its arms, is committed to a peace process. Hezbollah will not return its arms. It's clearly not committed to a peace process, and it was not. It violates every international agreement.
I mean, again, in Northern Spain, we saw the same thing. ETA just said, okay, we'll come to the table now. It's not because they won some kind of.
Who wants to come to the table?
The ETA is the acronym. I can't pronounce it in Spanish, but it's the Basque separatists. They speak a separate language than the Spaniards.
Have they come to the table? They've come to the table.
They've come to the table because Spain is suddenly doing really well economically as a result of the economic union, and that economic good times have spread into the Basque region, and the Basques are now starting, instead of being an underclass, they're becoming a middle class, and they're saying, hey, you know, life's pretty good. We don't want to fight with the Spanish anymore.
Palestinians will be becoming middle class. There's a big difference between Basque nationalism and Islamism in the Middle East. They're fundamentally different. One is far more radical and far more entrenched in the culture. But even in Spain and even in Northern Ireland, it is only because the Spanish and the English did not back down. For years and years, they suffer terrorist attacks back and forth and back and forth, but the Spanish never backed down to the Basques. The English never backed down to the IRA. Both the Basques and the Catholics in Northern Ireland realized.
I'm not suggesting Israel should back down.
That they couldn't win.
I'm not, please don't put those words in my mouth. I'm not suggesting Israel should back down. And on the other hand, what I am suggesting is that, you know, the old phrase, you get more flies with honey than with vinegar. I think that there's a lot of truth to it.
Well, but
Osama bin Laden understands that, and Hamas understands that, and Hezbollah understands that, and why George W. Bush doesn't understand that, and you don't understand that, I'm baffled.
Well, because I don't think you understand the ideology that drives these people, and the fact that if we had offered hospitals and money and goodwill to Hitler or to Mussolini or to Stalin, that wouldn't have done any good in those countries.
Actually, probably
have to be destroyed before you can bring them freedom and well-being in the middle class.
All righty. Thanks a lot. Yaron Brook, ayanrand.org, the website, 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Welcome back to our program. You know, to get back to what Yaron said, he said, schools and hospitals wouldn't have stopped Hitler. Actually, if you go back and you look at the history of Germany after World War I, Germany lost World War I, and the Allied powers got together after World War I. They weren't called the Allied powers back then, but they basically, got together and said, okay, Germany, you participated in starting this thing, and you were a bad actor, and so you have to pay back France and England and some of the other countries for the damage. You have to make war reparations. This was the Treaty of Versailles. And they were punitive. They were huge. I mean, a huge chunk of money was going to have to come out of Germany in order to pay those war reparations. As a consequence of that, Germany, because it suddenly found itself so badly in debt, started inflating its currency, reducing the value of its currency, because it was denominated in Deutschmarks. In other words, they said, you have to pay us a trillion Deutschmarks. I don't know what the actual number was, but let's say it's a trillion. You have to pay us a trillion Deutschmarks, which was real money. And so the Germans said, okay, fine, we'll just make it so that a trillion Deutschmarks is enough to buy a loaf of bread. And that's what they did. And what it did, of course, is it wiped out the German economy and made it very difficult for people to get to hospitals and schools and things like that. And that paved the way for the rise of Hitler. And so, if there were voices back then, Woodrow Wilson among them, who were saying, no, wait a minute, let's not be quite so punitive on Germany. Yes, they were a bad actor. Yes, there should be war reparations, but let's make it so that they can handle it. Because it was, part of the theory, part of the philosophy of the severe war reparations after World War I was to so cripple Germany's ability to take so much money out of Germany that Germany would not have leftover money to build a war machine so that they wouldn't represent a threat again. And that punishment of Germany is one of the things that so radicalized the Germans that when Adolf Hitler came along and said, hey, they're humiliating us. They we owe them so much money. We're having to pay so much of what we have to them that we can't even have hospitals and schools, that function. There's got to be a better way. Follow me. They said, okay, cool. We'll follow you. I'm telling you, the foundation of this stuff is always economics. Because when you have people who have a middle-class lifestyle, when you have people who this is the essence of democracy, as Thomas Jefferson pointed out, is building a middle class. If you have people who really do, can live in peace and their needs are met and they want their kids to have a better life than they do, I mean, this is just fundamental human stuff. And that will trump ideology. It's the reason why in the United States we have right-wing Christian fanatics who are just as toxic as the right-wing Muslim fanatics in the Middle East. Tim McVeigh was one of them, and he blew up the building in Oklahoma City as a consequence of it. But they are so marginalized, there are so few of them, because, you know, by and large, we still have a solid middle class in the United States, whereas in much of the Middle East, there is no middle class. It's just a disaster. And so, you know, I I'm not saying by saying that we should be doing right now is going into the Middle East and saying, okay, no more hostilities, and by the way, we're going to start building hospitals. Obviously, it's a little late for that. I mean, not to say that we shouldn't be doing that on an ongoing basis anyway. I mean, there is an armed conflict. Hezbollah is in the south of Lebanon. They are a state within a state. They do have thousands of missiles, and it's not right, and they shouldn't. And something has to be done about it. My opinion is that you're not going to be able to take them out militarily successfully without huge collateral and civilian damage, particularly because they've embedded themselves in with the civilians. And so, you know, what are you going to do? It's this, and which brings us back to, sorry, there's no easy answers here. But the main step, the first step, is for the United States, one of the most powerful players in the region, if for no other reason than that we're giving money to all these folks, for the United States to be involved in diplomacy. I have to agree with the Catholic Church. Here, this Catholic.org, right, Catholic Online, the official news release here, from Lecome, Italy. Pope Benedict XVI condemned Hezbollah terrorist attacks and condemned Israeli reprisals as acts that can never be justified in his first public comments on the escalating Middle East violence. He said, and I'm quoting the Pope now, neither terrorist attacks nor reprisals, especially when they have such tragic consequences on the civilian population, can be justified. Bitter experience shows that by following this path, no positive results can be achieved. The Holy See condemned Israel's attack on a free and sovereign Lebanon and terrorist actions by the Lebanon-based Hezbollah, as both risked the conflict growing into a conflagration with international repercussions, and strongly urged that sincere negotiations begin. So you've got, you know, Bush yesterday basically echoing, he'll echo the Catholic line when it's consistent with his base, with his Protestant base. He'll quote the church, oh, you know, we're anti-abortion, we're anti-stem cell, you know, quack, quack, quack. You know, which is also the Vatican's position. But when the Vatican comes out and says, no, you shouldn't have attacked Iraq, or the Vatican says, you know, both Lebanon and both Hezbollah and Israel are overreacting here, you're not hearing anything about that from the Bushies. No, not a chance. After the break, your calls and more on Israel and Iraq, 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm a hard-working man, I'm a son of a gun. I've been working all week in the noonday sun. The woods in the kitchen and the cows in the barn, I'm all cleaned up and my chores are all done. Take my hand and come along, let's go out and have some fun. Come on, darling, put a pretty dress on, we're gonna go out tonight. Dance, dance, dance
all night long. And welcome back, Defending America from the neoconservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Here's another example of it, although I would say easy one. World War II, after we defeated Germany and Japan, what did we do? We provided them with the means to build hospitals and schools. And they are our allies to today. And these were countries that pursued, you know, what you could call hateful ideologies, that you believed that we should be destroyed, that they believed in the, you know, racial superiority, you know, just right on down the list. Germany and Japan are allies today. We helped them build hospitals and schools after the end of World War II. And here now, China, this from the Wall Street Journal today. The headline, China, South Korea, bolster aid to North Korea. What do you do with a rogue regime? How do you bring them in from the cold? You help them out over the short term, even though, you know, you kind of hold your nose and say, you know, we're helping this dictator here. But it's really not him. It's his people. And if you help the people and you help the, and you know, build help build a middle class among the people, they will end up demanding democracy. They will overthrow the tyrants. This is what we should have done in Iraq. Obviously, we shouldn't have invaded Iraq in the first place, but after we had our successful war in Iraq that ended in May of 2003, we had about a six-week war, and we knocked down their government, we seized their buildings, an illegal war, but nonetheless a successful one, militarily successful. Knocked down their government, seized their buildings, took control of their cities, took control of their government apparatus, got their oil. At that point, we should have said, okay, here's some money. You guys know how to build hospitals. You build all the hospitals you have. You know how to build buildings. You build all the buildings you have. You know how to build power stations. You know how to build them all the ones you have. Here's a budget. Rebuild your country. Instead of saying, oh, we'll give the money to Halliburton, and they'll do it at five times the cost and take 3 years to do what the Iraqis themselves could have done in 6 months. I mean, that's where our policy in Iraq went wrong, was because, again, we were pursuing if we terrify them enough, they will decide we're their friends. No, I'm sorry. If you terrify them enough, they're going to get really angry. And their children are going to get really angry. And their grandchildren are going to get really angry. And you're going to have multi-generational violence. And again, in the Korean Peninsula, here, this article by Evan Ramstead today. Food aid to North Korea rose 23% to 1.08 million metric tons last year, lifted chiefly by donations from the governments of China and South Korea. In a sign of the heavy investment the two countries are making to keep their impoverished nation, that neighbor, stable. I mean, it's just straightforward stuff. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. JR in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, JR, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, man, I tell you, you hit it right on the head, buddy. I mean, you hit it right on the head. I agree with what you're saying. Outstanding job.
Thank you.
I wanted to tell you this also. You know, first of all, I'm Muslim. And I'm living here in America. I love America, okay, no doubt. But I hate them. You know all about that. I don't even have to go through that. But you know what really bothers me? I have so many Jewish friends. We don't have that problem. We don't have the problem that they're having over there. And you're right. It's sort of confusing to look at and say, well, why are they fighting like that? I mean, I would almost denounce my religion to be human. First, yeah. Take off your cloak of religion for a second. Take off your cloak of whatever knowledge that you have, and look at a person as they're human. These people over there, I disagree with the Muslims, what some of the Muslims are doing over there, killing, you know, becoming terrorists. Sure. But you sort of understand some of it. Why, you know, I understand the Jewish part of it also. But they're not.
Well, this is what's interesting. I mean, you walk around in for example in Jerusalem down in the Old City, which is mostly Arab, and they're Muslim Arab citizens of Israel, living a relatively middle class life, and they're not the fanatics. I mean, they're saying,
exactly.
Hey, you know, life is good. Why should we start a war?
Exactly. Tom, you hit it right on that. I'm telling you, man, take your cloak off for a minute. Or just at least say, hold away. First of all, before I become a Muslim, or before I tell you I'm Muslim, or before you tell me that you're Jewish, or before you tell me that you're Christian, look at the human side of it. And if you look at the human side of it, Tom, all this BS, all the stuff that's going on, all the people that want to stay in power, all the people that want to, you know, to use people for oil, and all this other crazy stuff that's going on in the world, be human first, Tom, and we got the key. You keep doing what you're doing, my friend. You keep doing what you're doing. I'm going to continue being human, and whatever religion I want to be, let me be that. I don't have to fight or kill you because I have different thoughts or different ways of life. You know, I'm listening to all my Jewish friends, some of the Jewish friends thinking, you know, well, they should, the Muslims should be doing it. And we sit down, we have an argument about, you know, have a little bit of an argument about it, and go about our way. We work. So, you know, everybody's going home, and everybody's, you know, able to live. And it's like, my God, why can't they do this all over the world?
Because at the end of the day, what it often, very often comes down to is economics. It comes down to land. It comes down to, and it comes down to poverty. It comes down, and so very often, I mean, you know, we're fighting communism in Central America during the Reagan administration. Really, what we were fighting was poor people. I mean, and the poor people saw in communism some hope, and you know, it wasn't necessarily the right hope. Maybe it was. I don't know. It's arguable, but it's not about. Ultimately, it's not about ideology.
Right.
More often than not, it's about economics. JR, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466. Our number. Joel in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Joel.
You're kind of right and you're kind of wrong.
Okay.
There's an article in the new U.S. News and World Report, the July 24th issue. As a matter of fact, it's a two-page editorial. And it discusses what has gone on with Hamas and with Hezbollah. Israel had been in Lebanon up until about 6 years ago when they withdrew with the understanding that the Lebanese government was going to patrol the borders and see to it that there would not be terrorists lobbing rockets into Israel.
Right, and it wasn't quite that simple. There was the United Nations Resolution 1559 that said that the U.N., including the U.S., was going to help the new democracy of Lebanon make that happen, and we failed to do it because the Bush administration just sat on their hands.
Absolutely, I agree with you there. But you also have to understand that when they do get along, and for years, Iran, when the Shah was there, traded oil for farm implements with Israel. Israel got the oil from Iran, and Iran were buying tractors and farm equipment from Israel. The minute the Ayatollahs got into the thing, it became a holy war situation again.
Yeah, and again, the reason that the Ayatollahs got into this thing was because as the Shah of Iran's reign continued, Savak became a more and more repressive regime. The middle class of Iran was gradually vanishing because the Shah was helping create another oligarchy. They were skimming the money off the top of these wealthy families, and so people, poor people, were saying, "Who's going to help us?" And the mullahs were there going, "We will." And
we will absolutely
agree with you on that. And that's why I say that the middle class is what you always want to have. A middle class will always demand democracy.
Situation. Arafat did nothing for the Palestinian people.
Right, and so they threw him out.
Skimmed all the money he possibly could from them and left them in abject poverty.
Right, and that's my point. I mean, that's where I disagree with Yaron. I don't think that people were voting for Hamas in Gaza because Hamas had suicide bombers. I think they were voting for Hamas because Hamas was running schools and hospitals, and Arafat was putting the money in his pocket.
You're right to that extent. However, Hamas and Hezbollah have, when Israel withdrew and gave back the land, and they did it voluntarily, Hamas and Hezbollah pouted and screamed and yelled, "We did it, we beat him.
Yeah.
So they got a certain amount of whatever you want to call it, out of momentum out of that. But you still have Hamas, Hezbollah, Syria, and Iran, whose stated purpose is to wipe Israel off the map.
I'm not disagreeing with you, Joel. And therefore, it is all the more important that we be involved in negotiating in the region instead of George Bush saying, "I'm sorry, I'm going to go to Crawford, Texas, and go fishing and refuse to talk to me." Joel, thanks for the call. But Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian.
Hi. Yeah, I just want to say the guy from Iran Corporation, whatever it was mistaken. I forget the name of the current president of the Palestinian Authority. He's the one who wanted to have a referendum among the Palestinians.
Right.
To see
you just scared his name out of me, too.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
To see whether or not they wanted to recognize Israel. Hamas was resisting it. They did not want to have a referendum.
Yeah, because in all probability, the people of Gaza would have said, "Yes, let's recognize Israel. Let's get on. Let's do some business with them. Let's get about the business of creating a middle class here."
Right. Yeah. So that is not why they elected Hamas. They didn't do it because they wanted to get rid of Israel. They did it because Hamas was actually honest and trying to help the people.
I'm not sure I'd say honest, but at least Hamas was feeding people and was running hospitals. And that's the lesson that we need to learn. And that's the lesson, by the way, that we knew. I mean, the United States has known that for a long, long time. And when we've done well in the world, we've done well in the world because that's what we've done. We've been the good guys.
Yeah.
And it's just so straightforward. And thanks for the call, Julian. And yet at the same time, we have to acknowledge, you know, Hezbollah in south of Lebanon has grown like a cancer down there, in large part because George W. Bush has sat on his butt for 5 years and done nothing. But they've grown like a cancer down there, and something has to be done about it. And, you know, whether that something is exactly what Israel's doing right now is a legitimate discussion for debate. But something's got to be done.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Don't get suspicious, but don't be suspicious, baby. You know you're a friend of mine. And you know that it's true that all the things that I do are gonna come back to you in your sweet time. I went from Phoenix, Arizona, all the way to Tacoma, Philadelphia, Atlanta, L.A., Northern California, where the girls are warm, so I could hear my sweet baby say, keep on rocking me, baby. Keep on rocking me.
Oh, yeah, keep on rocking. Truth in Broadcasting. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. By the way, a week from now, July 31st, it's a Monday night, I will be emceeing a gig in Seattle, Washington with Congressman Jim McDermott and former President Bill Clinton. So that should be a lot of fun. And it's a fundraiser. If you're interested in showing up, you can buy tickets at McDermottForCongress.com, McDermott for F-O-R, Congress.com. There's also a link to it over at, if you go to TomHartman.com and you go to our message board, David just put up a message there with the information and the link. It's at 7 p.m. at Ben Arroyo Hall. I think I'm pronouncing that right. It's 200 2nd Avenue in Seattle at 7 p.m. on the 31st of July. Should be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Casey in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Casey, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
That's right. Well, it's nothing even about politics. Do you ever watch the Dave Chappelle show?
I don't. I have so little time to watch TV. Why?
Right. He said your name on TV.
You're kidding.
The other night. So I was like, oh my gosh, he was doing a skit for Howard Dean.
Uh-huh.
And the speech that Howard Dean was giving when he was like super energetic. And,
right.
Yeah. And so Dave Chappelle was doing the same one, and he said, New Hampshire, and then he looked at the camera and he's all, Tom Hartman. And I was just like, oh my gosh. So.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. So I love Dave Chappelle, so I thought that.
Yeah.
Was.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
My
son is an absolute Dave Chappelle junkie, so he's good. I've seen him a few times. I think he's great. I just usually he's on after I'm asleep. And
So tell your son that he said his dad's name on TV.
I'll do that. Okay. Casey, thanks a lot.
No problem.
Great to hear from you. Kate in Arcata, California. Hey, Kate, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I really appreciate you starting to use the word occupation in reference to Iraq, but I'd like to suggest that we even rethink the use of the word war, because war implies that there's a legitimate enemy, and we know there isn't a legitimate enemy and that it actually was an invasion. So
that's
I'd
a good
like
point.
Like to start using the word invasion, and I think that Americans don't mind, they'll get behind the idea of war, but they don't like to be seen as invaders, because that implies, you know, like Hitler invading Poland.
Right. Well, that's
so
a good point. I'll start doing that, Kate.
If we start using the word invasion, I think it would be better.
Okay, you got it.
Okay.
I'll work on it. It'll take a little while, because, you know, it takes a while to break old habits, but I'll start working on that, and don't hesitate to call me and remind me again if I fail. Matt in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
Great. You just made a statement right before the break that you felt Bush let the cancer fester in Lebanon with Hezbollah.
Not just Bush. I mean, this isn't a bash.
Well,
Bush
you said moment. George Bush, though.
Yeah.
You said, yeah. And, you know, I guess my point is, I have a comment and a question. Number one, you know, what's the difference between him going in and taking out Saddam, which was a cancer in the Middle East, which he was criticized for that? And two, how much worse do you think the situation would be in Lebanon if Saddam was still in power? Those two questions are.
I think the situation in Lebanon would probably be a whole lot better if Saddam was still in power.
Why do you say that?
Because Saddam didn't represent a regional threat. Saddam was.
But wasn't he supporting terrorists in that area? And wouldn't they have a lot more support from him and the Palestine
The support for terrorists and fringe groups from Saddam was nothing compared to what comes out of Saudi Arabia, for example. You know, the Bush family friends and patrons. What Saddam was doing was he was sending a $20,000 check to the family of suicide bombers who blew
that's
themselves
up. That's
what
you know. That's what you know of. But you don't know, you know, I'm sure that there was other things going on. And
there weren't, Matt. I guarantee if there was, the Bush administration would have had, you know, their legions of people sometime during the last 4 years on Fox News telling you all about it. No, that was the beginning and end. Because frankly, Saddam was running a secular state. Saddam did not want Iraq to become an Islamist state. And so the Islamists, folks like Osama bin Laden, hated Saddam, hated him. The reason that Osama bin Laden got stripped of his Saudi citizenship and deported from the country of his own birth, where he was a multimillionaire and his father was a billionaire, the reason, which usually makes you pretty untouchable, the reason he got stripped of his citizenship and deported from Saudi Arabia down to Sudan was because he tried to raise an army to invade Iraq to overthrow Saddam, because he was so offended that Saddam was running a secular state where women could go to college, where women could participate in civil
wow.
society,
so,
where they didn't
so
have to wear the burqa. This is not to portray Saddam as a good guy. I'm just saying that there's a difference between a secular state and a religious state, and most of the religious states in the region, you know, viewed Saddam as, or most of the religious fanatics in the region viewed Saddam as more in our pocket, frankly, than anything else. He was, after all, a creation of the CIA. We overthrew Mossadegh and put him in there.
You don't think that if Saddam was still in power, they'd be fueling the fire down here, because he hated
no.
Israel more than he hated anything.
No, I don't. I don't buy that for a minute. I'm sorry. Saddam's first priority was Saddam. He wanted his own comfort. He wanted to write his novels, and you know, he wanted someday for his sons to run his country.
Okay.
No.
Well, let me.
He was not the danger in the region. There are some real dangers in the region. The mullahs in Iran, for example. But
well,
no, not Saddam.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that what would George Bush have, what could he have done to get rid of Hezbollah before this happened?
That's a really good question, Matt, and I don't have a 10-second answer for you, but that's all the time I've got. Let's bring this topic up another time and get into it, or perhaps in the next hour we can.
We got to
take a break here. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Coming up next, Congressman Ron Paul's going to be with us at the bottom of the next hour. No? At the top of the next hour? In the third hour. Oh, in the third hour. Okay. Sorry about that. Slowly figuring this all out. Right here on the radio, on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in Little Beirut, as George Bush Sr. refers to the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live 6 minutes after the hour. And the Bush before the NAACP. I should let you know what I'm choking on here before I choke on it. Bush before the NAACP. Here's a group representing African Americans, the African American community, and 59 African Americans would be eligible to pay the estate tax this year. Meanwhile, almost 25% of African Americans in the United States live under the poverty line. That's worse, by the way, than when Bush came into office. Then it was 22.7%. Now it's 24.7%. That's more than 9 million people. 9 million African Americans living under the poverty line. 59 African American multimillionaires who might pay the estate tax. And so Bush comes before the NAACP. Does he mention poverty? No, not once. Instead, he uses it to pitch for the end of what he refers to as the death tax, the estate tax. Does this guy have no shame? Anyhow, that is speaking of politics and political activism, time for our political activism alert for the day.
Hey, Jake, are we together? they take longer. They got the guns, but we got the numbers. Gonna win, yeah, we're taking over. Come on!
Yeah, they got the guns, but we've got the numbers here. Right now in Jackson, Mississippi, an intense confrontation is taking place between defenders of reproductive freedom and right-wingers determined to shut down Mississippi's last abortion clinic. A multiracial coalition including Jackson Now, Radical Women, Anti-Racist Coalition, Common Ground, Feminist Majority, Unity Mississippi, and World Can't Wait are facing bomb threats and aggressive harassment while police act as buffers for the far-right Operation Save America, formerly Operation Rescue. And the latest outrage by these multi-issue fascists was the burning of a Koran and a gay rainbow flag. This from a letter from Radical Women, and an email that I received. The fetus fetishists of Operation Save America, today's version of the reactionary bigots who beat and murdered civil rights activists and bombed black churches in an attempt to quell the African-American freedom movement of the 1960s. They say your voice and quick action is needed to help our embattled sisters and brothers in Mississippi. Call or email the following public officials and demand that they condemn the vicious actions of Operation Save America. And these officials are Haley Barbour, the governor of Mississippi. His phone number is 601-359-3100. David's going to put this on our bulletin board in just a moment here, so it'll be available to you. Haley Barbour, the governor of Mississippi, area code 601-359-3100. Eric Clark, the secretary of state for Mississippi, 601-359-1350. And Frank Melton, the mayor of Jackson, area code 601-960-1084. Give him a call and tell him that you stand with the rights of women, reproductive rights of women, and against these crazies who are trying to shut down the last abortion clinic in Mississippi. Frank Melton, the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, 601-960-1084. Eric Clark, the secretary of state for Mississippi, 601-359-1350. And Haley Barbour, the governor of Mississippi, area code 601-359-3100. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Peter in Leiden, Massachusetts. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Yes, hi, Tom. I've got a couple points I would like to make. One, that Hamas and Hezbollah are now being labeled as terrorist organizations and have been for some time. But it must be remembered that throughout Israeli history, almost every prime minister was labeled a terrorist and over time was legitimized by the conquest, let's say, or their victory of their rebellion.
Well, it's a little bit of Middle Eastern history that I think most Americans, you know, Menachem Begin blowing up the King David Hotel, for example.
Exactly.
But I wouldn't say every prime minister has been labeled a terrorist, but certainly Begin was. But also, you know, in defense of Menachem Begin, they notified the folks at the King David Hotel that it was going to be blown up to try and minimize civilian casualties. There's a big difference between that and a suicide bomber getting on a bus full of civilians.
Well, yes, but it must be remembered that there is an illegal occupation that has been going on for 40 years, and we must put it in perspective.
Well, we're getting into the area where, you know, one person's legal is another person's illegal. And Peter, I'm agnostic on this thing. I wasn't there when it happened. But the point is, we're not going to solve that problem.
It just seems that over time, Israel has become a sacred cow. And when one criticizes the policies of Israel, you are either called an anti-Semite or a self-hater if you happen to be Jewish. And this is not right. There's been a concerted effort by AIPAC and other organizations to demonize Arabs and Muslims in particular, but their own groups that are pacifistic in nature are seeking a two-state solution or some reconciliation between the parties.
Now, there is an active and visible and viable and part of the political infrastructure, by the way, you know, with members in Parliament, peace movement in Israel.
Yes,
and I think the thing that we have to to make really clear in our own minds is that there's a difference between Israel as a state, the Israeli people, which, by the way, includes Arab citizens as well as Jewish citizens, the Israeli people, and the policies of the current ultra-conservative Israeli government and or coalition. I mean, because Likud is actually a minority government, a minority party. But the other thing you need to keep in mind is that here's a country that is surrounded by other countries that quite literally come right out and say they want to destroy them. I mean, well, let me just finish the sentence. The United States making decisions about how we're going to interact with Canada and Mexico would be, I have a feeling those decisions would be in a very different context if Canada and Mexico had said that their stated goal, and they had the means to do it, perhaps over the long term, their stated goal was to destroy the United States.
Well, I don't think there's a comparison there, personally, but that's neither here nor there. It seems to me, though, that you have a situation in which parties are not speaking with one another. The United States refuses to speak to anyone it labels as a terrorist organization. Israel follows suit or is leading the United States as far as Middle East policy goes. And it seems to be very disturbing and bringing the pot to the boil.
I agree with you.
I think there's a fine line between state terrorism and what's called terrorism by Hamas and Hezbollah. And right now, to me, as an observer and footing part of the bill for the armaments for this, I feel very uncomfortable with Israel utilizing state terrorism against Lebanon. And
yeah.
I'll just close on that.
Okay. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Tom, for having this discussion.
Sure. You're welcome. I'm quite sure I wouldn't characterize what Israel is doing as state terrorism, but I do agree with the Vatican and with the president of the European Commission and the entire European Commission, as I recall they voted unanimously, that Israel's response to what Hezbollah has done has been disproportionate, that they've over-responded. But talk is cheap. You know, it's you really have to go there. You have to be in the region. I've been in that region many, many times over the last 25 years to get a sense of what's going on, how small it is, how tight it is, how intense the emotions are on both sides, on all sides. You know, and the fact lives are in the balance here. And the biggest tragedy of this whole thing, in my opinion, is the fact that there have been times when the United States, particularly during the Carter and Clinton administrations, when the United States tried to act as an honest broker, and not as a partisan in the thing, but as an honest broker, saying, okay, we understand the positions of both sides, and we're going to sit down with you at the table and try and work this thing through. And we made tremendous progress. I mean, bringing Egypt out of a war with Israel. I was on one of the first flights between Israel and Egypt back when they first started this thing with, I think it was called Nefertiti Airlines. The planes didn't even have numbers on them. They were just aluminum tubes, literally not even a number on it. Because at that point, Egypt couldn't officially acknowledge Israel. Israel couldn't officially acknowledge Egypt, but they'd agreed to have flights between the two. And Louise and I, with our youngest daughter at the time, she was 6 months old, flew over to Cairo and just in time to see Anwar Sadat shot. That's a whole other story. Anybody who tries to boil this down to one simple, they're bad, he's good, it's just wrong. It's not a simple situation. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ah, yes, the official slogan of the Bush administration, take the money and run. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, right here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Our senior NAACP correspondent, Victoria Jones, is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom, how are you?
I am just great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Good, good. Very, very fantastic. Thank you. Yes, I attended the speech that President Bush gave to the NAACP this morning at their convention. And he received, I wouldn't say it was a tepid welcome. It was a polite welcome. There were a couple of times that he did receive a standing ovation when he arrived, which is just polite. And also when he talked about signing the Voting Rights Act, that's when they got really animated, and they genuinely clapped and cheered at that point.
Yeah, but I understand he mentioned poverty zero times, but he made a pitch for the end of the so-called death tax, the estate tax.
He did make a pitch for the end of the estate tax. I wouldn't say that he got a massive response to that.
Yeah.
And, generally speaking, I don't think there are many people in any audience to whom the death tax applies anyway. So
right.
you're going to get a pretty low response to that unless you're speaking to, I don't know, maybe a major Republican audience. So,
yes.
The one time he did get some boos was when he was talking about education, No Child Left Behind, and school vouchers.
Oh, interesting. Now, he also claimed that his party was the party of Lincoln. I just have to say, I think if Lincoln was alive today, he'd be a Democrat.
Well, you know, I've often thought about that and about Lincoln being a Republican, because I look at the Republican Party, and not having the history of having grown up here, all I know is that I was plonked down and saw the Republican Party in 1987, heard that Lincoln was a Republican, and went, say what?
Well, let me give you a little background then. By 1856, the Democratic Party had become essentially the entrenched, corrupt party of slavery and very, very strong in the South. And there was a number of progressive movements that had emerged to take them on. The Whigs, who were the last iteration of what we would today call the Republicans, the conservatives, had collapsed. They were started in the 1820s, 1830s. And they came out of the ashes of the Federalists, who were the very first ones, you know, John Adams and company. And so in 1856 in Jackson, Michigan, the Republican Party was founded as a progressive party. And in fact, if you go over to TomHartmann.com and click on Articles on Democracy, there's an article about halfway down the page titled Republicans, Please Take Your Party Back, in which I quote from the Republican Party platform of 1874. And the Republican Party at that time is calling for equal rights for women, abolition of separate but equal, abolition of slavery, property rights, minimum wage, rights for unions. I mean, it was the progressive party from the time it was founded in 1856 until around 1886. In 1886, the railroads basically bought out the Republican Party, and the Republican Party became the party of big business, and the Democratic Party, which had been trashed as a result of the Civil War because they were the party of the South, the Democratic Party began to come back as the new progressive liberal party, which they are today. How's that
wow.
for American History 101?
Wow.
So that's why I say Lincoln today would be a Democrat. He'd be an FDR Democrat, because Lincoln was the first president to actually support strikers. He intervened in Chicago when Chicago was going to send the police in to break up a strike, which meant that, in all probability, they would kill people, because that's usually what happened. He stopped them. He made the famous statement, labor is superior to capital because labor precedes capital. In other words, you can't have money until somebody makes something. And he was on the side of the strikers. So. Interesting.
Very, very interesting. Very, very interesting.
So, and I suspect the other thing is, you know, I mean, you're a new citizen, relatively speaking. I'll bet most Americans don't know that. That's
no, let's be honest, Tom. Most Americans don't know a quarter of the stuff that you know. You are a brainiac.
Well, it's not that. It's most Americans just don't know American history. I mean, everything that I'm sharing with you is stuff that I first learned in school in the 1960s that they just don't teach in civics class anymore, because during the Reagan administration, Reagan essentially they started beating on the schools and saying that if they were teaching American history, it had a liberal bias and therefore they shouldn't do it anymore. And so they, for all practical purposes, don't teach American history, at least not modern American history. So anyway,
well, we need.
Yeah,
clearly we need to.
I agree. We have 1 minute left, Victoria Jones. What else do you see happening in Washington, D.C. today?
I asked Tony Snow whether he could state categorically that we're not holding back on calling for immediate ceasefire so that Israel will have time to, quote, defang Hezbollah, unquote, as a senior administration official has stated. And he assured me that that was not the administration's policy.
Hmm. Interesting. Although that's what's been leaked to the press.
Right, exactly, and he doesn't know who that administration official is.
So is Tony Snow in the cold, or is this part of the good cop, bad cop routine that's being played by the
administration? It's a very good question. This is the same man who yesterday, when I asked the question, told us that he didn't have top secret clearance.
That Tony Snow himself doesn't have top
secret
clearance?
That's correct. If you go to the website, you can hear the question. It's absolutely fascinating. He admits that he does not have top secret clearance.
Oh, my goodness.
And as the AP guy who sits next to me turned to me and said, holy bleep, we have a press secretary who does not have top secret clearance.
And that's is that a precedent, do you know?
Don't know the answer to that.
That's an interesting one.
Yeah.
Oh, keep on it, Victoria. We're all there with you. You're doing a great job. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria, for being with us today. It's 27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. We'll be back with your calls and more news right after this.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartmann.
I am the egghead. I'm the commander. I'm the decider. Cuckoo, choo.
I'm the decider, and I decide what is best, and what's best is for Don Rumsfeld to remain as the Secretary of Defense.
Sitting in a White House garden, talking to the Lord. But my thoughts would be busy, busy hatching if I only had a brain. I am the egghead. I'm the commander. I'm the decider. Coo coo choo 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 choo.
That's how this all works.
Yeah, he's the decider. Welcome back. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartmann Radio Program. Syndicated by Air America Radio, owned by me. Welcome back, AM. So, what can I say? David thinks that's funny. It's true. We have a comment line, caller comment line, for those of you who don't want to actually go live on the air but would like your comments heard on the air. It's 503-323-6620. 503-323-6620, and we've had a few callers leave comments for us, so I just thought I'd share them, a few of them with you. Here we go. Here's one.
Evidently, Mein Kampf is the only book that George Bush has ever read.
That would be in reference to my reading of Mein Kampf day before yesterday on the anniversary of its publication. This guy's evidently it's the only book Bush has ever read. Yeah, maybe.
I just want to thank the president, that is President Bush, for restoring dignity to the White House as he said he would. Again, thank you so much for the dignified response to the world today.
That, of course, in response to Bush's use of the S word the other day. Here's another one.
I have an article on my computer. I've had it there for 4 months, and my dad asked me to forward it to him today, and when I tried to open it up, it said this page cannot be displayed. It's a bunch of negative stuff about George Bush. Then I transferred it to my other email, and it wouldn't come up either. So the government is inside my computer. My dad has fought in 3 wars. He's a retired colonel in the Air Force, and I don't know why they are monitoring me.
Well, let me just, number one, isn't it a tragedy that Americans are getting this paranoid? And legitimately so. I mean, here's the story that in April, the federal government was spying on students in Berkeley, California, you know, and that they got on the terrorist list, people who were just going to plan an anti-war march. I'm telling you, the Bush administration is spying on Democrats. They are spying on their political opposition. And why the Democrats don't talk about it is beyond me. Maybe they're terrified. I don't know. But to the woman who called in, I would suggest to you that in all probability, what you have is an email that has HTML code embedded in it that points to a particular website to get some information that will then display in the email. And probably that website has changed, and so the information is not displaying. So odds are it's not the government inside your computer. Instead, the government just reads your email as it passes out of your computer. So, you know, good news and bad news. Here's another one.
You know, on the Tom Hartmann Show, I have never heard a word of support for mothering. I have heard Tom Hartmann disparage a transgendered woman.
Now, that would be my comments about Ann Coulter. And
will the real Tom Hartmann please stand up? Instead constitutional chauvinism is no more attractive or progressive than institutional racism.
Good point, and I agree with her comments. And my comments about Ann Coulter have nothing to do with whether or not she's transgendered. They have to do with the content of her hate speech. But I'm not gonna. I'll just let the comments stand. I think that's somebody who doesn't listen to the program all that much. Troy in Longview, Washington. Hey, Troy, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. How are you doing today?
Great. What's up?
Great. Hey, you know what? I love listening to your show. I think you provide very well-balanced, equally sided points and counterpoints of what's going on. But what I'm thinking about this morning is, we're talking about building hospitals, building schools in other countries. How can we basically form a movement, per se, to provide necessary medical equipment and supplies to these countries, let them know that, hey, just because this president is inept, the hearts of the American people are not at war with the Iraqis. We're not at war, with all these other countries that we want to help.
Here's the problem. There was a movement right after the invasion. And after the successful invasion and the occupation began, there was a movement among Democrats in the House and Senate to promote what would be a modern version of the Marshall Plan. In other words, let's send some cash over there and let the Iraqis rebuild their own country, because we know they know how to do it. They built their country in the first place.
Right.
And in fact, the first general, whose name is escaping me at the moment, the first guy that Bush had in there, said, okay, let's have elections and let's send some money over here and let's do a Marshall Plan. And Bush got rid of him in a hurry, because the real plan was to turn Iraq into a neocon paradise, to prove that Harry Truman was wrong. You know, Harry Truman and Franklin Roosevelt after World War II, Roosevelt was dead by the time most of it happened, but after World War II, they rebuilt Germany and Japan by saying, we're going to give you strong protection for labor unions and, help create a middle class and restrain corporate behavior and have tariffs and basically the liberal agenda, as it were, free public, healthcare, national healthcare systems, things like that. And it worked. It created two of the three strongest economies in the world as of this moment, Germany and Japan. And
right.
So the conservatives have been chomping at the bit for the better part of 40 years, saying we want to make a country absolutely conservative. We want it to make it in the mold that we think a country should be, to prove that it'll be even better than Germany and Japan under the liberals. And so Paul Bremer went in to do that to Iraq, and they changed the Iraqi constitution. He issued more than 100 orders. They banned labor unions. They said any corporation can do anything it wants in the country. Corporations can bring in labor from outside the country regardless of what they pay. There's no more minimum wage. There's no such thing as illegal alien labor. Anybody can be brought in. You don't have to use Iraqi labor. They're selling off all the nationalized businesses, all this kind of stuff. And the result, of course, has been a disaster. And so really what we need is a Marshall Plan for Iraq, but you're not going to get it as long as this administration is in power.
Right, absolutely, and I agree. I mean, and what I'm suggesting is leaving the government out of it, and that we start an organization as American people, not necessarily we give money, but I mean, to these other, I mean, there's got to be TV and radio.
There are a number of them already, Troy. There are a number of organizations, of social welfare organizations, who are doing work in Iraq right now. The problem is it's becoming increasingly difficult for them to operate in the country. It's been 4 or 5 months since anybody checked in with me on this stuff, but most of them have left the country because it's just so very, very dangerous. But the woman who was kidnapped back, 5, 6 months ago, the American woman?
Right, I'm not necessarily meaning, put Americans in harm's way, but again, if we use the nationals of those countries, then we're providing, we're providing support, we're providing pharmaceuticals, we're providing immunizations for their children, so providing books to send to them, so that they can start their own little infrastructure and just do it in the name of the American people. And,
yeah. Yeah. We need more of that, but it's going to be, I mean, we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars via Halliburton and Bechtel and you know, Blackwater, you know, all that kind of stuff. And the Iraqis see this, and they know that these guys are being paid $150,000 a year, whereas the average Iraqi makes $500 a year. I mean, they know what's going on, and it's just not cutting any ice with them. But I agree with you, Troy. It would be a great idea. I just, you know, and I think we all need to encourage American charities to be active in the region. As I've been saying, I think that if we had stepped into southern Lebanon and outdone Hezbollah in building hospitals and schools, that they wouldn't have been able to gain a lot of the traction that they did. But anyhow, Joe in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I there's so much to talk about. It's so hard to decide how to start. But I have an idea about this Israeli-Lebanese thing going on because in 1999, George Bush gave a speech at AIPAC.
Which Bush?
What was that?
Which George Bush?
He addressed...
In 1999, was it Bush Jr. or Bush Sr.?
It was Bush Jr. on May 22nd,
okay.
2000, at AIPAC.
Mm-hmm.
And he was explaining to them of our undying loyalty and commitment to Israel. Because he, in his words, he says that our commitment with Israel in the peace process... is a key role that the United States should play, but my support for Israel is not conditioned on the outcome of the peace process. America's special relationship with Israel precedes the peace process, and Israel's adversaries should know that in my administration, the special relationship will continue even if they cannot bring themselves to make peace.
And at that point in time, Israel was the only democracy in the region.
Yes.
I mean, there's a lot of reasons why that actually makes sense.
In a way. But then he's also going on and he talks about missile defense. Then he goes on to say something that was really odd, and that was when they kept saying that he was not a peacekeeping nation,
mm-hmm.
that is not what we do.
Right.
He he said that he would not interfere in anything that happened internally inside Israel. No administration, as the preceding ones had done, should interfere or put timelines on the mission that America has with Israel. Then I started thinking about it, and I ran across a Washington Post article from 2 days ago, and the article headline is really odd because it starts off with saying that missile war is a new challenge to Israel's long rule of the sky. And they claim, as another article tab, that Israel had the most powerful, most heavily manned weaponry. They want to put a missile defense shield over Israel, and they have a $35 million contract that didn't get budgeted last year with Northrop.
Oh, interesting. So now the SDI is spreading. And another contractor boondoggle, is that the point, Joe?
Well, the point is they want to do the laser thing through the space
mission.
That's
amazing.
What's about going. And this
amazing.
Still had a partnership with them.
We'll see. We'll have to see how it plays out. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
My money, I'll tell you what I do. I would go downtown, buy a Mercury or two, 'cause I'm crazy about a Mercury. Cruise up and down this road, up and down this road.
There you go. Welcome back. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. 9 minutes before the hour, 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Kevin in San Diego, California. Hey, Kevin.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great. What's up?
I have a question, man.
Sure.
Seems as if to me, from a spectator point, it seems as if the Democratic Party feels as though that they own the exclusive rights to African-American votes. It's like, you know, you were speaking about George at the NAACP convention a little bit earlier. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of George Bush. I mean, trust me, I've been very critical of him in the past. I mean, but it seems as if he's damned if he does and he's damned if he doesn't. If he doesn't attend the convention, which he hasn't in the past 5 years, he's criticized for not attending the convention of the oldest civil rights organization in America, as he should. But then when he does attend, I mean, you know, people bring up things like, you know, he talked about the estate tax and he didn't talk about poverty. And I agree with you. I think that he...
Right. When Reagan spoke before the NAACP, he talked about the issues that many of the issues that the African-American community is dealing with disproportionately compared to the white community in the United States.
Absolutely. Well, I totally agree with you. And like I said, I have no argument with the fact that you said that, you know, he didn't speak about poverty or anything like that, or he hasn't addressed issues which concern African Americans. But, you know, my thing is this, is that I just feel like from a strategic standpoint, I feel as though that, you know, for African Americans to just all line up behind Democrats, I feel like that's counterproductive for us. Because I feel like the people, like you, if you look at the leading candidates for the 08 election, I mean, you know, what are they laying on the table for African Americans? What are they going to do for African Americans? I mean, it just seems as if, you know, everybody now, you know, the Ted Kennedys and so forth, everybody's pandering to the illegal alien lobby. But I mean, you know, it's like, you know, what are they going to do for African Americans? I mean, and that's my thing. I mean, we're all Americans. I agree with that. But we can't deny the fact, and George Bush addressed this when he appeared at the convention, that, you know, slavery is a stain on this country's record, and it's never been cleaned.
And it's still echoing. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, here's my thing is what are these candidates, what are they going to do to address, you know, to address the problems that African Americans face and have faced for decades?
Well, that's the question. I agree with you, Kevin. And these are the questions that the individual candidates have to be answering. And for example, George Bush is saying, you know, all problems between the races in terms of inequality have been solved. Therefore, we need to do away with affirmative action. You know, I don't believe that that's true. I think that's nonsense. And historically being really only the last 50 years or so, because, I mean, as I pointed out to Victoria an hour ago, Democratic Party was the party of slavery 150 years ago. But over the last 50 years or so, the Democratic Party has been the party of working people, of blue-collar people. And as African Americans have come more and more into the mainstream of the American workforce, out of slavery and then out of 100 years of legal apartheid, the entry point into the American workforce has by and large been being working people, you know, blue-collar jobs and those kind of things. So the African American vote has been largely a Democratic vote. And the Republican vote has been traditionally the business vote, you know, the pro-business vote, the big business vote, and the more affluent white suburbs. The Republicans are trying to reposition themselves as a party that should appeal to everybody no matter what by saying, hey, if you hate gays, you're one of us. If you don't like abortion, then you're one of us. You know, using just a very small number of very, very tightly focused wedge issues to try and bring in entire groups. And, you know, we'll see if it works. It looks like to some extent it is. But, historically, I mean, that's why most African Americans, at least in my observation, I mean, you probably have a better ringside seat at this than I do, but that's the historic reason why African Americans, at least over the last 50, 75 years, have been voting Democratic instead of Republican.
Well, the thing that you said about the Republicans and so forth, about, you know, basically they're using wedge issues, I think that that's true for some in the Republican Party, because I think what happens, you know, Tom, I mean, and I think you'll agree with this, is that I think we tend to paint, you know, each other with broad brushes. I mean, I think that
sure.
There's Democrats who tend to paint Republicans with broad brushes. It's just like with the immigration issue. Anyone who's for securing the borders is automatically deemed a racist or a xenophobe, but I don't agree with that. I mean, I don't automatically agree with that, and I don't agree with that everybody who has a D next to their name that they are automatically for black folk or they're progressive. I don't agree with that. I mean, because
no, you're
again,
right.
Again, what have you done for me lately? That's my whole sentiment. What have you done for me lately?
That's
what
right, Kevin, and that's why you have to be. That's why you have to. You have to get it back to the local issue. You have to be asking these questions of your individual politicians.
Absolutely, and I'm doing that. I'm doing that.
Good on you.
And that's why I call your show, because you tend to, as far as I'm concerned, you tend to, I mean, you have an open mic. I mean, you know, you lay issues out on the table, you know, and you allow individuals such as myself to be able to respond to those issues. And I thank you, and I appreciate you for that, because you do provide a service.
Well, thank you, Kevin. Thanks. And thanks for the call, and thanks for making a good point.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466. Jay in Statesville, North Carolina. Jay, we have a little less than a minute left before we've got to wrap up this hour. What's up?
Okay, I'll try to make it brief, and I won't go into long detail about how much I love your program and how you're such a kind, decent, fair host.
Well, thank you,
Jay. The best.
Okay. To the topic.
Okay. Anyways, about a month ago on the all-night powerful AM stations, after your show's done, I tuned in, and they had a guy who straight on to politics. And he said that really there's only two parties, and they're not Republican or Democrat. What it is the rich against the poor.
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious.
Well, it's actually the rich against the middle class and the poor. But yeah, I agree with you.
The rich against everybody else.
Right. The DLC and the Democratic Party are representing the rich, and primarily the corporations. And there are a lot of progressive rich folks, by the way. I mean, like Kevin said, we can't broad brush everything.
I am broad brushing. It's the Republicans are representing the richest 1%, and they're against the other 99% of us.
Yeah.
And for George Bush to have even more than 1% approval rating means the other people got sucker punched into saying that he's all right.
Yeah, and they did. And it was with, hey, be afraid of the gays. Hey, be afraid of, somebody who might want to burn a flag someplace. It's like, what? But you're absolutely right, Jay. And thank you very much for the call. After the break, the victory of Measure T in Humboldt County, California, could work in your community to reduce corporate power. We'll talk about that right after this. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Measure T passed successfully in Humboldt County. And Caitlin Saposi-Belknap, the Executive Director of Democracy Unlimited for Humboldt County, is with us, duhc.org, the website, or perhaps easier to remember, votelocalcontrol.org. Caitlin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on again, Tom.
Sure. We talked about this before when it was on the ballot. It's a local story for one of our affiliates, KGOE in Eureka, which is in Humboldt County. But it's also, I think, one of the reasons why I wanted to revisit it is this should be something that every county in the United States should be working on. This is something everybody all across the country should be working on. This is such an important measure. Tell us about Measure T.
Well, what Measure T did or does now is prohibit non-local corporations, so corporations that are not headquartered here in Humboldt County, who don't have all their shareholders and employees living in the county, or who are owned by another corporation. Those corporations can no longer contribute money to political campaigns in Humboldt County.
Or politicians,
right.
Yeah, political campaigns. And now, does that include things like ballot initiatives that don't have a politician associated with them?
Right. It's candidates, initiatives, referendums, and recalls.
Now, Caitlin, you can find Measure T over at duhc.org or votelocalcontrol.org. Caitlin, it seems that this would fly in the face of a series of Supreme Court rulings that have said that corporations are persons, that the First Amendment guarantees right of political speech to all persons, that because corporations don't have mouths, therefore money must be the same thing as speech. You know the Supreme Court rulings I'm talking about. And Buckley versus Viejo, I mean, all the way back to First National Bank First National Bank versus Bilotti, and all the way back to Santa Fe, the railroad one.
The Santa Clara County.
Yes, thank you, that I wrote the book about. Yes, you can tell it's been a long day. How are you going to deal with that?
Well, there's two things in that regard. I mean, the first is that we wrote Measure T so that because the Bilotti case that you mentioned, First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti, actually did say that communities would have a right to restrict corporate involvement in elections. However, they said that Massachusetts, in the case that they were specifically hearing, was not able to sufficiently prove that the reason for those restrictions was that corporations' contributions were undermining citizen confidence in elections and causing the perception of corruption. So we took the language from that Bilotti case and from other cases that have, been part of that decision, and we tracked that. We put that right into the law. And so Measure T, when it was voted on by the voters of Humboldt County, we were saying, well, that's why we're passing this law. So the exception that the Supreme Court allowed for is the reason why we passed Measure T.
So you're going along with the Supreme Court instead of against it.
In a way. I mean,
it's like judo.
We're making that argument so that, you know, we will have legal grounds. But the bigger issue here, of course, is that what Humboldt County took a step towards is building a movement of communities and people and individuals who are challenging this idea that corporations can have rights. Because if corporations have rights, then, or personhood status, it makes it so that our communities cannot meaningfully protect ourselves against corporate harm, which to us is makes it impossible for us to have meaningful democracy in this country. So we're part of building a movement to challenge that idea, and, you know, the Supreme Court has been challenged before. There was a movement against slavery that, you know, the Supreme Court was upholding at the time. There was a movement for women to gain the right to vote. The Supreme Court said women were not people back when corporations even were. So the Supreme Court's been wrong many times, and there is no reason why we should stand for that when we know that a corporation is not a person, and we know how much harm that causes to democracy when they have that legal standing. So we have to challenge them. Nobody's going to do it for us, so that's what we're trying to do. And we want other communities to pass similar measures because it'll be so much stronger if that happens.
And they can figure out how to do it by going to votelocalcontrol.org and just basically cloning what you've done, Caitlin.
Right. And our work now is both defending Measure T should a lawsuit arise and also helping other communities pass this measure. And that's the work that Democracy Unlimited does. And so if people do want to do this in their communities, we would be happy to work with them and tell them what we learned so that the process is easier for the next group than it was for us.
Right, and the contact information is over at the website votelocalcontrol.org or DUHC, as in Democracy Unlimited of HumboldtCounty.org. And, Caitlin, you also put an escape hatch, or maybe that's the wrong phrase. You put an opportunity, an option into this law for local businesses to still have a voice in politics. So if I own the local drugstore and there's something before the city council that's going to, you know, widen the street in front of my drugstore, or they're going to zone it or something like that, I can still go in and I can support a candidate that you know, takes my side on the issue, or I can put money into a campaign because I'm a local person who owns a local business.
Right. Well, we had a lot of debate about that as the group who wrote the law, and what we ultimately decided is that the people who own local businesses, and it's a very narrow definition of a local business. I mean, you have to have all your employees, you have to be headquartered, your primary place of doing business has to be here.
You're really a local business,
exactly. And what we felt is the people who own those businesses are citizens in our community, and they're not using their business status to trump the rights of our community, which is what corporate personhood is about. And so, you know, this wasn't an anti-corporate measure so much as it was a pro-democracy measure. And when we looked at the history, our local businesses are not pouring hundreds of thousands of dollars in on one side of an issue locally, like we had seen with a couple initiatives and a recall. Those were just the big corporations. And so we didn't want to punish local business owners who may use their checking account, you know, that kind of thing, because it is important that if we are going to build a movement for democracy that we include local businesses, because they're hurt just as much as anybody else by the Walmarts and the Home Depots of the world.
Right. Did the people of Humboldt County make the affirmative legislative finding that corporate contributions in elections are imminently undermining our democratic processes and are denigrating rather than protecting First Amendment interests? Brilliant. Caitlin Saposi-Belknap, the executive director of Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County, votelocalcontrol.org or DUHC.org. Caitlin, have any other communities, to the best of your knowledge, picked up on what you did with Measure T here, and are they trying that in their own communities?
Well, nobody's working on a ballot initiative quite yet, but Mendocino County, which is just to the south of us, there's a group of people who are very interested in running a similar campaign, and we have been receiving, you know, contact from people, folks in Florida, some folks in Wisconsin. People are really excited about what we've done, and, you know, it's a matter of putting together a group, because this process did take us about 2.5 years from when we started thinking about it to the voting day. But hopefully now that we've done it, you know, it wouldn't take that long for somebody else. A lot of it was writing the initial draft of the law.
Well, and getting the word out. I mean, we have a very active anti-corporate personhood movement here in Portland, Oregon, for example. I'm surprised that they haven't connected with you and carried something forward like that here.
Yes, well, getting the word out is really important, and that's, you know, I do appreciate so much that you're having me on your show again, because, you know, so often people don't hear about these things, and so that's also what we're trying to do. So spread the word, listeners.
There you go. Yeah, you can go to duhc.org or votelocalcontrol.org and get the whole story on Measure T and the victory that they actually had in Humboldt County in the recent elections. Caitlin Saposi-Belknap, the executive director. Caitlin, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks. And if you don't have a website, you can always call us at 707-269-0984 if you don't do Internet.
Okay, 707-269-0984. And you can drop by the Tom Hartman message board and just post that on there if you want.
I'd be happy to do that,
yeah,
of course.
No, just drop in and great. Caitlin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Great talking with you. It's 15 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. And 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Rick in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Rick, we have about a minute before we have to take a break. What's on your mind?
Yes, sir. Great to talk to you again. I just found out about this Senate bill 2453 before the Judiciary Committee of Arlen Specter yesterday. I didn't know if you knew anything about it.
Senate Bill 2453, is that the one that basically gives Bush the option of spying on Americans or gives him the right to spy on Americans and the option of running it by the courts? Is that what you're talking about?
That's it, the Specter-Cheney bill.
Yeah, the New York Times reported on that a couple of days ago, and what was amazing was all the media, I mean, virtually without exception, ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, they all said, oh, Bush has given in. He's going to have congressional oversight. He's going to have judicial oversight. And, in fact, the law that Specter's promoting would give Bush the option of having oversight. I'm assuming that that's your point about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Senate Bill 2453. Contact your member of the United States Senate and say, no. No, we want Bush to follow the law and be held responsible for the law. Rick, thanks a lot for raising the topic.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And if you want to call your senator, the number is 888-355-3588. Toll free across the United States, 355-3588. 888-355-3588. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bossed Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
Yes, we're taking our country back one congressional district at a time, featuring progressives running for Congress across the United States that you can support, whether they're in your area or not, folks who need your support, who can make a significant contribution to taking back America. Today, our Taking Our Country Back candidate, David Sanders. He's running for Congress in the 4th Congressional District of Indiana. His website, sanders4congress.org. David Sanders, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Hey, David. Glad to have you with us. What? First of all, tell us about, you know, the race that you're in.
Well, I'm running for Congress in the 4th District. It stretches about 3.5 hours north to south in Indiana. It's quite a gerrymandered district. But I'm running against Congressman Steve Booyer, who is vulnerable because he is the chairman of the Veterans Affairs Committee, and he has done nothing but try to cut veterans' benefits.
Oh, he's absolutely trashed veterans.
I'm sorry?
He's absolutely trashed veterans. I mean, it's amazing.
He's been trying to prevent them from testifying before Congress. He has called the leaders of their various veteran service organizations a number of terrible names. He's referred to veterans as whiny, as shallow. He was put into place by Tom DeLay in order to cut veterans' benefits. The quote from a Republican staffer was, he was supposed to tell veterans, enough is enough. We're not going to give you any more. This is exactly the wrong message to be providing when we have people serving overseas.
Yeah, but it is the Republican message.
It is a Republican message. And I've been in communication with the office of Nancy Pelosi about trying to deal with these issues. And when the Democrats would place Republicans in Congress, when they take back Congress, we are going to make sure that veterans' benefits receive the priority that they deserve. These are not arbitrary benefits. These are benefits that they were promised and that they have earned. And it's very important that Congressman Booyer be replaced. And I know this not because I'm just saying it. I hear from veterans every single day. I must receive, or I have been receiving, 40 emails, letters, or phone calls every single day from veterans throughout the country, including the district, urging me to do whatever I can to defeat Steve Booyer.
That's great. Well, I wish you the very best. You've got a great website, sandersforforcongress.org. I encourage all of our listeners to go to it right now and check it out. We're talking with David Sanders. He's running for Congress in Indiana against Steve Booyer, the Republican who's chairman of the Veterans Committee and just slashing our veterans. It's just terrible.
Absolutely.
You also, Dave Sanders, at the top of your website, sandersforcongress.org, you say an excellent public education system is critical for our economy and our society. Is that one of your signature issues?
It is one of my issues. I am a professional educator. I am a professor at Purdue University. I work on biodefense issues, and I've actually participated in the Defense Threat Reduction Agency's biological weapons proliferation prevention program. And as part of that, I traveled to Siberia to a formerly secret bioweapons lab to try to make sure that the scientists there are strictly doing civilian research now. And I really understand the role of research and education in society. I think it's important to have representatives in Congress who understand science and education and technology on a first-hand basis.
What can we do, David Sanders, to make it easier for kids to get into and through college, for example?
Well, one thing that we need to do with regard to getting them into and allowing them to stay in college is to decrease the interest rates on college loans. The Republican Congress has decided that they're going to balance the budget by raising the interest on student loans.
They just did it last month.
And it's gone up about 25%, and you're probably familiar that in the last decade, we've gone from a situation where college aid is about 70% aid and 30% loans to now 70% loans and 30% aid. There has not been an increase in the amount of money going into these programs since the Republicans took over Congress, and there has been, college tuition has continued to increase, and I should mention, since I'm a professional, a large part of that is increases in healthcare costs. And if we want to get tuition under control, we need to improve the healthcare system so that these costs do not continue to escalate.
Are you in favor of a national healthcare system?
I am in favor of I'm in favor of universal health insurance. That is, making sure that we have a single-payer system for health care that will increase the competitiveness of American businesses. It will eliminate the vast number of uninsured in this country.
It's the thing that we need
for our economy and for the health of the American people.
Well said. David Sanders for Congress. The website is Sanders, S-A-N-D-E-R-S, for forcongress.org. Check it out. David Sanders running against Stephen Booyer in Indiana. Drop by, give them some support, my friends. Thank you, David, for being with us. 27 minutes past the hour. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to Talk Radio for the Rest of Us, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 34 minutes past the hour. Just a quick reminder, a week from Monday, I will be emceeing a fundraising event in Washington State, in Seattle, with Congressman Jim McDermott and former President Bill Clinton. It's at 7 p.m. at Benaroya Hall. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And if you want more information about it, you can go to McDermottForCongress.com, and it's all right there. McDermott for Congress.com. And I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to getting up to Seattle again, too. It's a beautiful city. So, also, the New York Times reporting that the top human rights official at the United Nations, this is Louise Arbour, who is the former Chief Justice, former Justice of Canada's Supreme Court, was the Chief Prosecutor for the International Criminal Tribunals for Rwanda and Yugoslavia. She's the woman who indicted Slobodan Milosevic. Okay, so we're no slouch here, Louise Arbour. She knows what she's doing. I mean, former Supreme Court Justice in Canada and the former Chief Prosecutor for the International Criminal Tribunals out of The Hague. She has said that the killing and maiming of civilians under attack in Lebanon, Israel, and Gaza, and the West Bank could constitute war crimes. To quote her verbatim, she said, as reported by the New York Times today, the scale of killings in the region and their predictability could engage the personal criminal responsibility of those involved, particularly those in positions of command and control. She went on to say, international humanitarian law is clear on the supreme obligation to protect civilians during hostilities. That same obligation exists, she added, in international criminal law, which defines war crimes and crimes against humanity. She went on to say, indiscriminate shelling of cities constitutes a foreseeable and unacceptable targeting of civilians. This came out of her Geneva office. Similarly, the bombardment of sites with alleged innocent civilians is unjustifiable. In addition to the United Nations saying this, and at least her saying this on behalf of the United Nations, the International Red Cross said yesterday that Israel has violated the principle of proportionality provided for in the Geneva Conventions and their protocols. Now, they're not limiting, of course, their criticism to Israel. They also noted, this is the International Red Cross, that Hezbollah was firing rockets into northern Israel, and they said Hezbollah fighters, too, are bound by the rules of international humanitarian law, and they must not target civilian areas. As the New York Times notes, at the United Nations, there was support for the view that the only way to spare more victims was to halt the fighting, but there was also evidence that the United States would continue to dispute that. The ambassador from France, which holds the current presidency of the Security Council, it rotates, Jean-Marc de Sablière, he says, we think a truce is needed for humanitarian reasons. But John Bolton, the American ambassador who was never confirmed by the Senate because he's such a whack job, said, quote, the notion that a ceasefire would solve the problem is simplistic. Among other things, I want somebody to address the problem of how you get a ceasefire with a terrorist organization, end quote. He said, this is a different kind of situation, and I'm not sure that old thinking, conventional thinking, works in a case like this, end quote. Yeah, that old thinking like, let's sit down and talk. That just doesn't work. Now, it's much better to just, like, you know, invade Iraq, for example, and then try to have your army occupy the country for 3 or 4 years and take the oil, change the nature of the government, and just make the people so very, very happy with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Steve in Springfield, Massachusetts. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Tom. How are you doing? I wanted to say that I've heard many people make the analogy that the incursion into Lebanon by Israel is just like our incursion into Iraq.
And no, there's a million differences.
And I would like to state one that's most notable to me, which is I think that the more accurate analogy is that it's like our incursion into Afghanistan. It is, and by the way, I have, though I support Israel, I have great problems with the proportionality, not only humanitarian concerns about civilian casualties, but I also just think if you be just very basic about it, Israel is doing a horrible public relations thing by destroying so much infrastructure.
Yes,
but I'm not
going to
second guess how much they know about where the rockets are. But what I want to say is they have not jumped mission. If they jumped mission and suddenly decided to topple the government of South Yemen or Turkey, I mean, to be utterly absurd, but that's how absurd I think it was to jump mission in Afghanistan and decide to topple the government of Iraq. They have not done that. They're in the place where they identified the original killers of the soldiers and kidnappers of the soldiers coming from. The second thing I want to say is I'm sure she's with all due respect, I'm sure she's, you know, an august jurist, but did this jurist, I don't know, I'm going to bring up the bad word of Fahrenheit, a bad title of Fahrenheit 9/11, but did she express the outrage at what we did to the city of Baghdad, the bodies of babies being pulled out from the rubble?
Yes,
in
she
Baghdad.
Did. Actually, yes. If you go back 3 years ago, she is on the record as saying that the United States may be guilty of war crimes and may be caught, brought before the court. Yes, absolutely. She.
Okay,
she is.
Then good.
And to bring this back to the Afghan analogy, I was opposed to the all-out bombing and seizure of the country of Afghanistan when we went in.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why was because Al-Qaeda at that point in time, and Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, was a relatively small, relatively obscure group. At the most, 20,000 people had gone through his camp, and at the most, and this is using CIA numbers, right? At the most, maybe 5,000 people were like hardcore supporters of his.
Mm-hmm.
And when we identified him as the guy who had something to do with 9/11, although oddly enough, on the FBI's most wanted list right now, he's not listed as having anything to do with 9/11. But in any case, when we identified him as the guy who had something to do with 9/11, Afghanistan said, okay, great, we'll turn him over to a third country where he can be held for trial. We'll arrest him and turn him over. And the United States said no. And, if we had simply gone in and taken out his terrorist camps and seized him and his merry band and held them the way we did Tim McVeigh, who, you know, committed a terrorist act in the United States that killed several hundred people also, another religious nut, only he was a Christian religious nut, and thinking that he was bringing about the end times, just like Osama bin Laden thinks he is. If we had taken out his training camp, and if we had arrested him, or if we had allowed Afghanistan to turn him over to a neutral third party like Germany or France or you know, a country where he would actually get a fair trial and in all probability end up, you know, being sentenced the same way he, you know, life in prison, it probably would be a country without death penalty, because most of them don't. Although if he was turned over to Saudi Arabia or something, I mean, they'd put him to death. But instead, Bush wanted to have a war. He wanted to have a war, and he had his war in Afghanistan, and it looked like it was going really well. And so then he wanted to have his war in Iraq, and that looked like it was going really well. And now both of them are blowing up in our faces. Afghanistan is now producing more opium than it ever has in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the narco-terrorists have taken control of the country. The Taliban is back because we just did a total halfway job there. And like I said, I don't think we should have invaded the country in the first place. We should have simply taken out bin Laden and then deal with the Taliban the way that you deal with other countries and you deal with other governments over time, gradually, slowly. You empower the people who are the opposition so that you have democracies that organically grow from the bottom up and they overthrow dictators. That's why there's over 100 democracies in the world today. There's only two of those that are the result, you know, Germany and Japan, are the result of any sort of military action, and I would argue that those are very, very special cases.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so. Can I just say one thing about the I'm trying to absorb all of that. That is very interesting. Thank you. But can I just say something about the fellow who called about private charities working in Iraq?
Sure.
I certainly was not in favor of the invasion of Iraq, and I hate to give a template for how it might have worked, but the none of the reasons given were had anything to do with what the reason was. And one of the why these people are still grasping at straws with ideas like that is this failure to see that this neocon group, their agenda is to establish these oligarchic capitalist countries informally, even if they're possibly nationally socialist, but formerly socialist countries.
Right, or even in the place of democracies, Steve. Even in the place of democracies. I mean, we had an opportunity. Again, we should not have invaded Iraq. It was illegal. We had an opportunity to establish a democracy there. And Paul Bremer said, no, we're not going to hold elections. And it wasn't until Sadr and his group went to the streets and said, yes, you are, that we finally backed down and said, okay, we'll have elections. We were going to have these caucuses and basically hand-pick people. Steve,
right.
Thanks for the call. I appreciate
all
it.
All right, thank you.
Very, very thought-provoking. Good conversation. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program, Exposing the Con in Conservative. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartmann program.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. Well, they're still trying to figure out what went wrong in Ohio. And this is the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Election report blames officials. Missing details grew into ballot failure. For nearly 3 months, the biggest mystery in Cuyahoga County's May 2nd primary debacle has been whether blame goes to the optical scanning machines that were unable to read thousands of absentee ballots or the company that printed the ballots. But Monday results of a scanner test solved the mystery with a new culprit, the Board of Elections itself. Gee, these are the folks who work for Ken Blackwell, who's running for governor in that election. Which used a ballot layout that was unreadable by the scanners. But the Denver-based company hired to find out why the machines failed, Systest Labs, also points the finger at Diebold Inc., the maker of the scanners. Diebold did not bother to warn its customers that placing two thick black lines on ballots could create problems, Systest found. Results of the May 2nd election were delayed for a week as election workers labored to hand count thousands of absentee ballots. And on it goes. Of course, this is just to call this the tip of the iceberg is to say that global warming might be a minor inconvenience, to future generations. That's just not the case. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Tom in Seattle, Washington, on the line. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I just want to give you a couple of kudos first on coming up for that town hall. We appreciate you coming up to Seattle and supporting what's going on and coming back again. Thank you. And sure. On this whole, I'll get to my point here in a second, the whole embryo thing, could we change the paradigm? Maybe these are organ donors, you know, with this genetic material. Anyway, my real reason for the call is...
Actually, if we could just take that one step further, if Bush is going to say that a fertilized embryo, you know, a few cells on a Petri dish, is a human being, then why not issue them Social Security numbers?
Exactly. Because he doesn't want anybody to think about Social Security.
Well, you never know. They might end up being considered illegal aliens if you don't have Social Security numbers for them.
Right.
And then what happens, the 90% of them, they get flushed down the drain. I mean, are we going to start arresting the in vitro fertilization labs? Now, actually, that's what the Vatican would like. This is in vitro fertilization is officially anathema in Catholicism.
Yeah, I think they're kind of winning the. He's trying to win the war words there, but I just a thought. I listened to you guys in the other AM 1090 shows, but I do want to kind of pick a bone with you on the idea of what Israel's doing, not necessarily being state sponsored terror. I mean, the retaliation. I mean, if you have a family and you get the bigger kid and the little kid and. You know, little kid did this, and the big kid's doing it back to him. It's the retaliation, and it's the escalation. And if Israel isn't striking fear into the hearts of the civilians of Lebanon, you know, and maybe it's a definition thing when you say state-sponsored terror, but from where I sit, I don't understand how you say it's not state-sponsored terror.
Well, I agree with the European Commission, the European Union, the EU, and the President of the European Commission, and the Vatican, that it is a disproportionate response. That's just short of saying it's state-sponsored terrorism. Because state-sponsored terrorism is where, you know, a state is just, you know, radically going over the line, and I just think that that's such an inflammatory term that it's not going to advance any kind of dialogue.
Okay.
It's not going to help the situation at all. It's going to further polarize it. I think on the other hand, to acknowledge that, you know, in the first place, Hezbollah should not have had these missiles. They shouldn't be, you know, doing this. If they want to, they really have to make a choice. Do they want to be outlaws, in which case the world and the police agencies of the world should be going after them as criminals? Do they want to be outlaws and, you know, have weapons and missiles and whatnot, and, you know, play the old IRA game? Or do they want to be political players and, you know, run hospitals and schools and have seats in parliament? You can't have both. Hezbollah has to make that choice. But if they're going to be armed like that, and they're going to be kidnapping Israeli soldiers and things, there is going to be a response. And obviously Israel has responded, and I'm not opposed to Israel responding. I do, however, think that Israel has responded in a way that is disproportionate, that they've gone overboard on this.
Yeah, disproportionate response. I'm just feeling a little bit apathetic to that phrase. I mean,
That's a phrase that has a lot of meaning in diplomatic circles.
Okay, but maybe I can accept that. Fine, they're not a state sponsor of terrorism, but their behavior to me now appears to be state sponsored terrorism.
Their behavior is certainly scaring the hell out of a lot of people. I mean, you've got all these refugees. You have a 500,000 refugees in a country of 40 million people. Or is it 4 million people?
Soldiers know what they're signing up for. Children trying to go to school. You know, grandparents, families, it's just...
But see, again, the same could be said of the kids in Haifa.
Agreed. Totally agreed. And
that's why for us to point at one of the parties in this and say, it's you,
it's
just not a healthy thing for us to do. We need to bring the parties together at the table. And frankly, as I've been saying all along, 4 or 5 years ago, the United States, when Resolution 1559 was passed. Actually, I think that was just 2 or 3 years ago. But the United States should have been sitting down with Lebanon, with, you know, a democracy with whom we have formal relations. We have an ambassador to Lebanon. We should have been sitting down with them and saying, we're going to help you disarm Hezbollah in the south, because that's a cancer growing, and we're not going to let it get worse. And the Bush administration has been absolutely incompetent at solving any of the cancers around.
I completely agree with you. They're vacant. They're just absent, and they're doing it. But what Israel is doing it on our dime. We're funding it. And the fact that the Bush administration is vacant from the table, we're total agreement.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Thank you.
I appreciate
it. Keep it up.
Good to hear from you. Coming up on tomorrow's program, Andy Stern, the international president of the SEIU, is going to drop by to challenge America's CEOs. Hey, team up with labor to solve the nation's health care crisis. Bernie Sanders will be here, our Brunch with Bernie segment. That and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people. Remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information.